This podcast is brought to you by Squarespace. Whether you need a landing page, a beautiful gallery, a professional blog, or an online store, it's all included with your Squarespace website. Creating your website with Squarespace is simple. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code Guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. Hey, I'm Jessica Valenti, Guardian columnist, and this is What Would a Feminist Do? Throughout history, people have been obsessed with youth, feeling young, defying death, and of course, looking young. We haven't quite found that fountain of youth yet, but we have found Botox, a cosmetic procedure that's performed millions of times annually. And that number is growing, especially with women. But why is this procedure and so many other cosmetic surgeries or fillers so appealing to women? In Hollywood especially, female celebrities are expected to stay youthful, but not in a noticeable way. If we can tell someone had work done, we shame them. I'm not going to name particular celebrities because I don't want to add to the bizarre fascination with that shaming, but it's amazing that we not just expect women to look young and beautiful, but effortlessly so.
I don't know if it's tough to see, but she definitely looks like a different person altogether.
The 45-year-old made an appearance at the Elle Women in Hollywood Awards last night looking, well, different.
After confessing to getting a second nose job.
Her face is overblown.
She has changed all third portions of her face, upper, middle, and the lower third of her face.
Injectable fillers.
An upper lid blepharoplasty.
To Botox.
The Real Housewives of Atlanta star looks completely unrecognizable in her latest bikini photos.
Why do we criticize women for adhering to the beauty standards that our culture inundates us with? How do we move beyond the question, is cosmetic surgery feminist or not? And have a nuanced conversation around aging, body image, and women's personal decisions versus systemic issues. To talk about this, I'm joined by Dana Berkowitz, Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's and Gender Studies at Louisiana State University, and author of the upcoming book, Botox Nation.
Enter Botox. Here's this product that can seemingly liberate the face from its resting bitch state.
But first, a short rant. When I was younger, I was extraordinarily judgmental about cosmetic procedures. I didn't understand why people would do this to themselves, allowing what I saw as unnecessary surgery on their bodies or getting needles to the face. It all seemed so anti-feminist, like acquiescing to the beauty standards without a fight. And, you know, of course, I knew that women were judged, but I didn't consider the toll that that judgment can take on you, especially as you get older. Of course, I absolutely want to live in a world where people aren't pressured to look any different than they do and where women can age unfettered from ridiculous expectations. But we all do negotiate living in a sexist world in our own way. And there's a big difference between critiquing systems and critiquing people. So, to my younger self, I would say relax and mind your own business when it comes to people's faces and bodies. So now, to discuss all this, I'm joined by Dana Berkowitz, Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's and Gender Studies at Louisiana State University and author of the upcoming book, Botox Nation. Dana, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dana, Botox Nation comes out in December, and the book primarily looks at sort of the cultural phenomenon of Botox. Can you talk to me a little bit about it and why you were interested in the topic?
Sure. So the inception for this book began like about 10 years ago. I was still a graduate student, and I was living in Gainesville, Florida, which, if you know anything about Gainesville, Florida, is not the most glamorous of all college towns. And my friends, you know, I was in my mid to late 20s, and my friends were all living in New York and Los Angeles and Miami, and they were working in these, you know, very high paying jobs, or at least they seemed like high paying in comparison to my graduate student salary. And we came home to Miami, where I grew up, and we all met at a party. And one of my girlfriends pulled us aside and she said to us, you know, guess what I did today? I got Botox. And I think the rest of us looked at her like she was crazy. Just, you know, she was, I think we were 28 years old and we were like, why in the world would you do this? And she said, well, I think her exact words were, you should do this too now because it's preventative. And if you do it now, you're going to prevent those deep lines from forming in the future. And I, after, you know, the initial shock subsided, I told myself that this was going to be my next project. And so after I finished my PhD and published out of my dissertation, which was, I decided that I was going to start writing this book about Botox. And that's the inception of it.
So you yourself have had Botox?
I have.
Can you talk a little bit about that decision and what it was like for you and why you didn't?
Absolutely. So it's actually quite serendipitous that we're having this conversation today, because tomorrow, for the very first time, I am going to come out to my students in my women's and gender studies class.
Nice.
As somebody who uses Botox.
Yeah.
I even wrote an essay that they're hopefully reading right now. that's called "What My Women's Studies Professor Uses Botox."
I love it.
And I wrote this to help me think through a lot of the tensions that I experienced and how I came to this decision to use Botox myself. And so. I began researching this book in 2010, and I was 31. I finished, you know, just about a few months ago, and I'm 38. And during this process of working on the book, I watched my skin begin to sag some. I watched these wrinkles appear between my brows, around my mouth. And it really impacted my sense of self. And it was then I realized how much I was invested in this sort of young, cute version of myself and how much my identity depended on it. In addition to all of this, what I was doing during this time was I interviewed cosmetic surgeons, I interviewed dermatologists, and in these interviews I asked them to point out which of my wrinkles could be Botox, which of my lines could be lasered, and it was quite agonizing.
That sounds terrible.
It was terrible. So, you know, this is research. And I'm voluntarily subjecting my face to these, like, very close readings by these medical and beauty experts. And then, even worse, I did an analysis of media messages about Botox, where for the better part of a year, I read women's magazines and beauty magazines. And this was a terrible, terrible idea for my self-worth.
Sure.
So I can really see how women are just so inundated with these messages that they're not good enough. And they can always be better. And then I also interviewed lots of young women who use Botox, some of whom were my friends. And they told me that I was stupid and that I was foolish and that I was silly for not trying Botox. And many of these women, I mean, my mother included, told me, how are you going to write an entire book about Botox if you haven't tried it? So I did. I finally did a few years into my research, and I was, you know, secretly pleased, but also, like, incredibly overcome with guilt and shame about this decision. I as a feminist, I felt like I had completely, like, failed. And so I was really felt this humiliation that I had capitulated to these very ideologies I was supposed to be critiquing. So here I am, a dedicated feminist committed to challenging gender inequality. And I am actively and knowingly participating in this, you know, very oppressive beauty culture.
So how do you negotiate that? I mean, and it is sort of interesting because we all do make our own negotiations, right, with beauty culture and with living in a sexist society. There, you know, I don't put makeup on because I like it. I mean, I like it a little.
No, but it is pleasurable,
right? It is pleasurable, but, like, it
because
probably
of the social consequences.
Correct.
And the economic consequences.
Correct. But there is... I do feel like we somehow feel differently. And, you know, you spend all this money on face creams and facials or whatever it is. But somehow we do think about cosmetic fillers or injections or surgery as different. Why do you think that is?
Well, I mean, you know, feminists have long been trying to make sense of these things, right? Women's participation in beauty culture has been at the fore of these debates. And cosmetic surgery, with its, like, severe and extreme bodily transformation, is really at the center of this conversation. And I think that so much of this conversation has been centered around debates of like, you know, is this feminist? Is this anti-feminist? Right. Is this empowering? Or, you know, is this capitulation to these patriarchal norms? And I think that trying to construct any sort of intelligent argument within the confines of this debate is just absolutely impossible. And I think we need to think about the ways that women's bodies are both voluntarily cultivated, but at the same time, they're also culturally objectified. And this is because we can't really think about this at the individual level. We need to really think about the ways that the tentacles of consumer culture, of anti-aging culture, beauty culture, cosmetic surgical culture, all of these things, they're just big pharma. I mean, they're just so far-reaching. So I think what I'm trying to do in my book is I want to change the conversation, and other feminist scholars and activists have done this as well, from thinking about this, you know, as an individual problem to one in which we talk about the institutional demands placed on women.
Sure.
And that these are occurring within a system of, you know, pervasive gender inequality where appearance is still, despite major feminist gains, you know, it's the defining feature of femininity.
Talk to me a little bit about Botox's effect on facial expression and why you say it's particularly enticing to women. What I thought was really amazing is sort of the link that you make between Botox and resting bitch face.
Yeah.
Right. And the emotions that women carry on their face. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So I think this is why Botox is especially disconcerting to me. And the rise of young women using the drug is again, I'm especially concerned with, because the wrinkles that Botox is designed to fix, and I'm using, you know, that in quotation marks, you know, these creases between our brows, they're also known as the 11s, or if you wait too long, the 111s. you know, these are the lines that can cause us as women to look bitchy, angry, irritated, all of these emotions that we're not supposed to show. And so the way that Botox works is when it's injected into these facial muscles that allow us to pull our eyebrows together and push them down, it paralyzes this motion. And again, this is the expression we use to project to the world that we are pissed off. For women who from early childhood are taught to look happy and pleasant, this can be quite appealing since we're penalized to, you know, when we look judgmental or angry or bitchy. And this is where the resting bitch face, or, you know, bitching resting face, it has two names. this is where this comes in. And so, you know, this unapologetically sexist pop cultural idiom refers to a woman's face at rest that somehow looks bitchy simply because she isn't smiling. And of course, you know, there's no name for men's serious, pensive and reserved expressions because we allow men these feelings. We allow men the space to display these feelings. But women are always expected to be smiling. I mean, how many times has a man stopped you on the street and told you to smile?
So many times.
And
it's my least favorite.
Yeah, and it's exhausting. So what I'm arguing is that, you know, here, enter Botox. Here's this product that can seemingly liberate the face from its resting bitch state, producing this, like, flattening of affect where the act of appearing pissed off and bitchy can be effaced.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah.
So what's sort of the difference between something like Botox and other facial fillers that mostly women get, right?
Yeah, absolutely. All of these, you know, facial fillers, Botox, you know, facial cosmetic surgery and cosmetic surgery in general. This is like over 90% women. So this is explicitly a feminist issue. And the main difference is that, you know, dermal fillers, they plump the face. They fill the face. They don't paralyze the face. And so when you paralyze the face and you inhibit your ability to make these movements, I think that is, you know, that's something we need to talk about, that, you know, women aren't allowed to look angry and bitchy. That's a problem.
Right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. Whether the story behind your passion is out of the ordinary or simply out of this world, you should tell it in an unforgettable way. Squarespace helps you do just that, with the only websites designed to showcase what makes your passion worth pursuing. Start your free trial today at squarespace.com/guardian.
Squarespace.
Today, we're talking about Botox and cosmetic surgery. Let's talk about Hollywood.
Yeah.
So, you know, we see this a lot that, you know, we don't want women, female celebrities to age. But once they,
right,
if they do have surgery or fillers to sort of adhere to those beauty standards, we're upset with them. Like, we want them to look young, but we don't want to know that they're getting Botox.
And, right. They have to look natural. They're supposed to get Botox.
And isn't that term so interesting, right? Like keeping yourself up, not letting yourself
aging
go.
Gracefully. Right. And it's you know, this really implicates, you know, women who don't have the economic means to do this.
Mm.
Because where we're being told that we should use Botox or we should take care of ourselves and we should get all these facials and use all these facial creams, right? We're not supposed to look like we do this, right? Because that, like, you know, spoils any success of this working. So when you have this increase in medical spas and in, you know, like, you know, we have Groupons that sell Botox now and give you these bargain deals on, you know, these cosmetic procedures.
Botox parties,
all of these things where you get in this deal. And this is to entice women of less economically privileged backgrounds to participate in this Botox culture. But what oftentimes happens is the work is more visible. And therefore, they're more penalized for doing the same things that, you know, wealthier women are doing. It's just, you know, much more invisible on their faces.
Right.
Because they can afford it.
So talk to me a little bit more about that sort of marketing aspect. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, speaking to a lot of younger women who have had Botox. How is it marketed towards younger women? Because it is something that you sort of think about as, you know, something that older women get or something that you're supposed to get as you age.
Right. Well, so like most cosmetic procedures, the vast majority of women who use Botox are, you know, middle-aged-ish, you know. But you have about 20% of women, 20% of consumers who are, you know, under the age of 40. And so Botox is being marketed to younger and younger women as preventative, and as this, like, responsible self-care, that you should, you know, grab the aging bull by the horns now and inject these, you know, barely perceptible wrinkles now with this, you know, nerve paralysis or muscle paralysis, because if you do it now, then you won't need that facelift in the future.
Right.
Right. It's almost like this. The facelift might be inevitable, but you'll have to wait for till longer to get it. It's, you know, it's like in my analysis of magazines, I saw this this metaphor of the house. Like, think of your face as a house. You know, you the upkeep involved in it. And, you know, just don't wait till it's falling down to take action, because then you're totally screwed.
So like you said, and I think that this is so interesting, so often this conversation is sort of framed around, you know, is Botox, is cosmetic surgery feminist or not feminist, right? And that is a really limiting question. How do we get to that more nuanced conversation around, you know, aging and beauty culture and personal decisions versus, you know, systemic issues? How can we make that conversation happen?
In my book, I talk about this, that we can't fault individual women for buying into this beauty culture and for using Botox. But at the same time, like, we kind of should, because while they're doing this, you know, they're, you know, sustaining this very oppressive system, right? And then, like, changing this standards of normalcy for everybody else. That said, though, what I also found is that if women refuse to do this, then they're called, you know, lazy, irresponsible, ugly, all of these things. We talk about this as, like, a choice or a dilemma. And I think it's a very false choice or a very false dilemma, because I think that instead of thinking about this as an internal conflict, I think we need to think about it as an external one, in which these feminist narratives that very correctly emphasize the perils of being complicit with beauty norms compete not only with this like multi-billion dollar industry that benefits from women's quest for physical perfection, but also with this growing post-feminist narrative that emphasizes, you know, empowerment and choice. And it's this vocabulary of choice and agency that, you know, give women the language to talk about injecting their faces with a poison as this like pleasurable act. And I think this post-feminist, you know, this rhetoric of liberation and empowerment and all of these things is really dangerous for that reason.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. But it is so, and you touched on this a little bit, it's so difficult to get to that place where, of course, you don't want to judge individual women, and we shouldn't, and we should be focusing on sort of the broader issues. But individual women's choices make up,
exactly.
Right, you know, and they matter.
Make up social structure.
Right, and I always worry that if we completely ignore, right, women's individual choices, or we say, you know, she chooses her choice, that's fine, we're at risk of basically sending the message that women's choices don't matter, right? And they do.
Absolutely. And, I mean, I think in addition to individual women, you know, coming forth and embracing aging bodies in a way that embraces aging as beautiful. You know, we have no choice. Like, we're going to age.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, we live in a world that where youth is valorized and where aging is, you know, it's just, I think we equate aging with dying. And I think that's part of it. But I mean, I think it's, you know, the responsibility of individual women who are in positions of power, mm-hmm. not to do these things. I mean, Deborah Rhodes documented how even women in Congress, in positions of political leadership, you know, that the second their hair grows gray, they dye it.
Right.
You know, they also use cosmetic surgery. They also use, you know, Botox and laser and fillers and all of these things. And so I think we need more visible role models.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think it's the media's responsibility when women are in positions of power not to, you know, tear apart their bodies and their looks. Appearance just cannot be the defining factor of femininity anymore.
Dana, thank you so much for doing this and for speaking with me. This has been great.
Thank you so much.
Dana Berkowitz, Associate Professor of Sociology and Women's and Gender Studies at Louisiana State University and author of the upcoming book Botox Nation, coming out December 7th. That's it for this week. What Would a Feminist Do? Is produced by Maggie Freeling. Katie Enders is the supervising producer. Valerie Lipinski is the head of multimedia. Our intro song is by Rook Day. If you like this podcast, please take a minute to rate us and leave a review on iTunes. It will help get the word out to others that What Would a Feminist Do? Is something that they should be listening to. I really appreciate it. I'm Jessica Valenti for The Guardian. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks for What Would a Feminist Do?